All right. Well, good afternoon, everyone. My name is Sean Crean. I'm based at the San Francisco Fed. I've been covering the intersection of emerging technology, innovation, and financial inclusion issues for over a decade during my career here at the Fed. And I'm just really excited to be moderating this panel on financial health. And just generally, it's super exciting to see the momentum of this conference in general. It's now the third year. And the growing focus on not just the idea of access as the goal, but outcomes. Just really, really excited that we're here to talk about financial health and thinking about the outcomes of that access that we as a community have been focused on for so long in the financial inclusion space. I think we can't belabor the point enough. I know many in this room are already thinking in this way, but just to kind of share a few examples and reasons and kind of some data around it. First, just a basic level, if we're thinking about another part of the economy, so medical services, it would be great to tell someone, okay, you have access to this medicine or you have access to this doctor or this medical service. But if they don't know whether that's going to make them healthier, if that's going to cure their ailment, that's really an insufficient way to measure whether that part of the economy is actually working for that citizen. So it's really, really important that we think beyond access when we're talking in this space. The FDIC has done a lot of work in this space trying to measure at a basic level the idea of access, and I think most people in this room are familiar with their unbanked survey, and the latest one of a few years ago, I believe, found that the problem of access has mostly been solved in this country, so maybe 5% of American adults remain unbanked. But actually some interesting research, including in that survey, but Fed economists have done, breaking down the percentage of that 5% that are not banked, not because they don't have access, but they choose not to access financial services. And there's been a lot of discussion today about trust or lack thereof. And I think one of the benefits of measuring things like financial health and looking at outcomes is connecting to that feeling of trust or lack thereof. It's really a lack of trust that the service is going to deliver the outcome that someone needs. So I think it's just really important, even if we're thinking about access, why people might choose not to access, and it's connected to those outcomes. And on the flip side of that, if you look at the 95%, if we take that number at face value of Americans that are banked, and then we bring in other data, for example, the financial health pulse score that Taylor's organization puts out, and he might talk about in a little bit, I believe the numbers ebb and flow year to year, but roughly 30% of Americans, according to that survey, are what Financial Health Network would consider financially healthy. The rest are either, using your institution's terminology, coping in some way, so kind of getting by but not fully healthy, or truly vulnerable. And you don't have to be a math genius to say, okay, that's well over 5% of the population. That's a lot of those people are banked. They have access, but the outcomes aren't there for them. Governor Barr and others today have talked about the role of other important drivers in this space, not the least of which is having a good job and a steady income. So we're not going to pretend that all of this financial health and all of these outcomes are just about financial services, but they certainly play a really important part. And that's why we're excited to be talking today with this panel and for you all to be engaging with us on this topic. So over the past few years, we've watched financial health move from an emerging concept to something with real momentum in the marketplace. What started as a way for mission-driven organizations to describe their values has evolved into something financial institutions are actively measuring, operationalizing, and embedding into their business strategies. The Federal Reserve has been paying close attention. We've been engaging with a range of stakeholders to understand what's happening in this space, and what we're hearing is both exciting and thought-provoking. Early adopters are reporting promising benefits. They're identifying vulnerable customers who might benefit from targeted interventions. They're looking at new ways to design products and services to meet customer goals. We heard about some of these examples in earlier panels. They're seeing some improvements in customer satisfaction. But so we're seeing this, but we're still eager to keep learning and hearing evidence of to understand what works for whom and how these approaches can scale to benefit the most vulnerable consumers, particularly low and moderate income households. The Federal Reserve's work on financial inclusion, and Jessica and others got this in previous panels, but our work on financial inclusion and community development has shown us that household financial stability matters for broader economic resilience. And the question now is whether and how financial health measurement can help institutions deliver better outcomes, particularly for those most vulnerable consumers. But to realize that potential, institutions need to measure what matters. They need to develop products and services based on those insights and then validate the impact so what works can scale. So today we're going to explore how financial health measurement and implementation are evolving in practice. We'll hear from practitioners on the front lines about what they're seeing, what evidence is telling us about impact, and where we need to go to scale this work to the broader market. And we'll talk about the critical role of partnerships across different types of institutions and with the public sector in making that happen. So I'm joined today by three leaders who are doing this work every day. Let me briefly introduce them. Taylor Nelms is Vice President for Research and Insights at the Financial Health Network, a nonprofit industry association dedicated to advancing financial health through research, measurement frameworks, and practitioner collaboration. Kristen Holt is President and CEO of GreenPath, one of the largest national nonprofit credit counseling and debt management services. Founded in 1961, GreenPath currently serves approximately 55,000 consumers who are collectively managing nearly $1 billion in debt. And last but not least, Ivy Glover from Wright Pratt Credit Union is the Director of Community Impact and Development there, but also the Executive Director of their Sunshine Community Fund. And Wright Pratt is the largest credit union in Ohio and has been serving members for nearly 100 years since 1932. So let's begin with some basic definitions of the topic, why it's growing in importance for financial inclusion efforts. I'm going to start with Taylor. Can you just help us understand what do we mean by financial health and tell us about the evolution of this field? How do we move from focusing primarily on that concept of access to thinking about outcomes?
Yeah, thanks, Sean. And thank you very much to the Federal Reserve for having all of us here today to have a conversation about financial health. We think that this is a huge, monumental in some ways, moment to see the Federal Reserve in its position in the financial services landscape really embrace financial health as a goal for the financial services industry and ecosystem in the United States and around the world. At the Financial Health Network, we define financial health in terms of a household's ability to make ends meet and stay on track in the face of financial setbacks. Our more formal definition is that a household is financially healthy when it's able to meet its current financial needs and obligations, when it's on track to meet future financial needs and obligations, and when it's able to absorb and recover from unexpected expenses or drops in income. As Sean has already really laid out very, very well for us, you know, the financial health movement really grew out of this recognition that access alone to financial services, even when they were really good, safe, affordable, high-quality financial services, wasn't enough by itself to guarantee positive outcomes for consumers. Sean mentioned the numbers that bear this out, the reduction in the rate of truly unbanked as well as underbanked consumers, and how those have really come down pretty significantly over the last 2 to 3 decades. While other measures of household financial progress, whether they're measures of financial health the way that we describe them or measures that we see through the Survey of Household Economics and Decision Making that the Fed runs or any number of other data resources, they haven't necessarily followed the same trajectory. And I think that gap has really pushed the field towards trying to measure outcomes directly, right? Like, can people pay their bills? Can they build their savings? Can they handle a shock? Can they manage debt? And so on. And I'll just put a finer point on this question around, or this difference, I guess, between access and outcomes. I think it's really important, considering the changes that we've seen in the supply side of financial services, that we really refine our understanding of what access, even just access, looks like. Simply using alternative financial services, non-bank providers, I don't think is a very good proxy for being underbanked today. In fact, I was just looking this up, but my colleague Andrew Warren at Financial Health Network has done some really fantastic work here. And by our count, we have one data point to suggest that nearly a quarter, 22% of consumers who say they don't have or don't know if they have a checking account also reported using a fully digital bank like Chime. And I think that that's just one small data point to suggest that the ways that people are engaging with financial products and services has changed really dramatically over the past 5 to 10 years. And we need to take that into account, even when we're just thinking about financial inclusion, and especially when we're thinking about how people use those products and services to solve financial health needs and problems. So I know we'll talk a little bit more about how we measure financial health in a little bit, but I'll just kind of end these introductory comments by saying I think financial health is a really helpful framework because it really does work for multiple audiences, right? So financial institutions certainly can use it to design better products and demonstrate their impact, track and demonstrate impact. But policymakers and community leaders can also use it to target interventions and evaluate whether their programming is working. And of course, researchers can use it to track household experiences and disparities that traditional macroeconomic indicators may miss. And I'll just emphasize this point, since we're here at the Fed and, you know, the state of the economy really matters. As a researcher, I think that household financial health and the health of the national economy are really important to look at together because they move together, right? Healthy households spend more reliably, they save more consistently, and they absorb shocks without cutting back sharply. And that stability really does add up to a stronger, steadier economy overall. And the inverse is also true. We know that big macroeconomic shifts directly shape household financial health. But if macroeconomic growth isn't translating into broad-based security and prosperity for families, then it's missing the mark.
Thank you. Ivy, I'll turn to you. Financial health seems like a natural fit for credit unions. In many ways, it's why credit unions exist. When and how did WritePat start explicitly using financial health language, and what does it mean to meet members where they are in terms of their financial health?
Sure. Thanks for that question, Sean, and I echo the appreciation to be a part of the panel this afternoon. You know, as you mentioned, I think credit unions have always been uniquely positioned to meet the needs of our members and our community where they are. In fact, that's how credit unions got started. The credit union movement is flavored by the people helping people philosophy. At WritePat Credit Union, our first financial health need was met almost 100 years ago on a base in Ohio when a worker fell ill. And at that time, we didn't have flex leave and paid leave. You didn't work, you didn't get paid. And his teammates put quarters in a sunshine box, what we call our Sunshine Community Fund today, but put them in a shoebox, and they made the first loan. And that first loan was paid back over time when the gentleman was well, and that was the first WritePat credit union loan. And what's interesting is many credit unions are positioned like us and got started in that way. There was a need that had to be met. That was the difference between sustaining through a storm or not, and that need was met. And so the work of financial health has been at the crux of what we and what credit unions have done for years, meeting that opportunity of trust and proximity and need in one place. In 2014, I think it was actually with Financial Health Network, we really forged partnership to begin more formally leveraging and learning and applying the concepts of what did it mean to be financially healthy, and in fact work to help engage and develop the score that is used today. We started to apply it locally with our credit union members in our industry so that we had both national and very localized data, and then we took that data to start to determine where the opportunity gaps were for the credit union and for the communities that we serve throughout Ohio. In 2019, I believe it was, we adopted what we call the financial flexibility and freedom approach. We like words at the credit union. We like to name things. And so in our mind, that was our way to think about what products, processes, and people needed to help with us meeting the need of weathering a storm in times of challenge or creating thriving environments financially. And we started to look at what different products and services and solutions, education that we may have not been offering yet were needed to go on that roadmap to do so. So we've been doing it for almost 100 8 years, more formally in the last 12 years. And it's really been interesting to see it evolve and where it will head. But like you said, I think that credit unions have and financial institutions are uniquely positioned to not only apply financial health metrics and processes for the business case or the bottom line product of it, but because of the proximity that they bring to the neighborhoods that those organizations serve.
Thank you. To Kristen, you work with consumers who are often in financial distress, many dealing with significant debt, budget deficits. What does financial health look like for the populations you serve, and how does your individualized, holistic approach differ from how a traditional bank might think about these consumers?
Sure, and thank you again for having us here. I'm really excited to engage in this conversation and grateful to our credit union partners. GreenPath partners with over 600 credit unions across the country, and the credit union institutions are often where someone will turn when they are struggling, and so we're really grateful for that opportunity to leverage the trust that the credit union has with their members to make that trusted referral over to GreenPath. The people who are contacting us often are struggling. I have lots of data that I can share, but I'd really like to share just the story of one person that we counseled, one of the 100,000 people that we counseled last year, and kind of just illustrate that situation for you. So we counseled Kim about this time last year, and she was referred to us by her credit union when she went to the credit union to get a consolidation loan. The credit union turned her down for the loan because she had filed for bankruptcy in 2021, and she had a credit score of 617. But the credit union also, as they turned her down for the loan, referred her to GreenPath, and she got into our counseling session. We call our counselors financial wellness experts. We want the people who are reaching out to us to feel like they're receiving something of value and they're receiving expertise because they deserve it. And she shared her story where she had filed for bankruptcy in 21. Then she got into a car accident and needed to replace her vehicle and was declined for the auto loan. And so she purchased the loan on credit cards. Those credit cards carried very high interest rates, as you might imagine, being a post-bankruptcy customer. And she was struggling to make ends meet, but she was current on all of her bills at the time that she reached out to us. She had $23,000 in credit card debt, and she made just under $30,000 a year. Her budget deficit at the time of counseling was about $1,100 a month. Our counselor spent an hour with her. It's human to human connection, really understanding her story and understanding her goals. And really the root cause of her issue was the low credit score. And so even though she was current on her bills, she needed to stay current and she was struggling with that deficit. And so through our counseling, really getting creative, listening, finding opportunities in that, we were able to get her budget balanced partially with the savings that came with a debt management program. So I want to take a minute just to explain nonprofit debt management. It's very different from what people might see in like the debt settlement world. So people, when they're working with a nonprofit debt management provider, they are repaying all of their credit card debt, but at much lower interest rates. So the payments go down, and they're able to repay that debt in about a five-year period. So through this creative counseling and finding opportunities to cut expenses, and there weren't much, but also getting the customer to agree to finding other sources of income, she was able to successfully enroll in the debt management plan, and I'm very happy to report that in just 9 months, her credit score moved up to 700, and she is still current on all of her bills and successfully repaying her debt. But you know, it's different than how a bank might be able to approach it. You know, they're not going to be able to get that whole story and that whole situation. The bank is primarily going to be concerned with getting their debt paid, you know, rightly so. And so we're able to take that time and build trust, leverage the trusted referral from a financial institution, and really get to the root of the issue and give real solutions that people can take up.
Thank you, Kristen. I want to talk about measurement now, how we can kind of get down to really understanding consumer financial health outcomes. How do we really know what we think we know? How do we validate what we're seeing? So let me start with Taylor, just kind of continuing the evolution, the history you were talking about. Why is this move from just being a concept, a way organizations describe their mission, to something that major institutions are now actively measuring? What's driving this moment?
Yeah, thanks, Sean. Let me start by talking a little bit about the measurement framework that the Financial Health Network has developed and a little bit about what we see nationally when we survey consumers about their financial health. And I think what's really interesting is that you'll hear some commonalities between Kim's story and some of the movement in her personal trajectory and some of what we seek to measure at scale when we try to think about what are the financial health patterns that we see across the United States. So at Financial Health Network, we measure financial health across 8 indicators, which we then sum into a score and put onto an index 0 to 100, and then sort people into categories based on some thresholds that we've established. But those 8 indicators are really simple. They're positive cash flow, on-time bill payment, short and long-term savings, credit score and debt manageability, confidence in the adequacy of your insurance coverage, and your ability to plan ahead. The FinHealth score has been adopted and adapted by hundreds and hundreds of organizations across the United States, including a bunch of financial institutions, banks and credit unions, fintechs, nonprofits like GreenPath or Habitat for Humanity or others that are providing direct services, as well as a bunch of industry and academic researchers. So, Sean mentioned this at the beginning of the panel, but we've been surveying consumers for now almost 10 years. We just got the 9th year of data back a few weeks ago. And you know, we see at a high level that consistently fewer than 1 in 3 households are financially healthy the way that we define them. And like I said, that's been pretty remarkably consistent over time. The share of households that we classify as financially healthy did increase during the early pandemic years due to forced savings and government and other kinds of support, but that spike has entirely disappeared. Looking now kind of across those 9 years of data, the share of households that are financially healthy has remained steady around 31%. But that stability at the population level hides a lot of movement underneath. And I think that this is a really, really important point. Each year in our data, and we have a longitudinal sample, so we can track the exact same households from 1 year to the next, we see about a quarter, 23 to 25%, depending on the year, of households move either up or down a financial health tier. In other words, their financial circumstances change enough that the way that we classify their financial health changes. So financial health is really dynamic for individual households. Through this work, we've also been able to surface some pretty significant disparities between different communities, both geographic and demographic. And so we also see that financial health is really variable depending on where you live and who you are. But this movement and this variability, I think that means that there are some real moments when people need help, and real opportunities for companies and other organizations to show up with the right products and services at the right time. And at the Financial Health Network, not to put too fine a point on it, we think that's a business opportunity, that financial health drives consumer engagement with financial services and financial services providers. So what's driving the measurement revolution? Just to kind of come back to this point that you've made, Sean, I think it's a mix of data and strategy. Institutions now, we heard this earlier in our conversations about AI, but even without AI, institutions have far richer transactional and behavioral data than they did even 5 years ago, alongside more sophisticated analytical tools to make sense of it. And I think that that's just opened the door to the ability to measure financial health more continuously and more holistically. We see that among traditional financial institutions, and we see that among a whole panoply of startups and fintechs who are doing really, really interesting things with transactional data, including, including underwriting, using, for example, cash flow data. At the same time, I think the business of financial services itself has changed as the landscape has continued to get more crowded and more fragmented, and as consumers' financial lives have evolved. So, for years, the industry conversation that we've been a part of was about establishing that financial health matters. You know, really making the case. Well, we're at the Federal Reserve today. We're talking about financial health. In some ways, the case has been made. And so now I think it's pretty clear that the industry conversation is about how to operationalize it. And I like that terminology that you used at the beginning, Sean. You know, how do we understand patterns of difference in financial health needs and behaviors across different segments of consumers? How do we build financial health into our product innovation or our service delivery design? And so the emphasis has really shifted from simply, you know, saying whether a household is financially healthy or not to really understanding under the hood what are the reasons why. And I think that because of this shift in the business context, we're seeing the value of measurement increase for financial institutions.
So let's talk about the operationalization. Ivy, what does measuring financial health mean operationally for a credit union?
Yeah,
anything that's surprised you?
So I like what Taylor just said about really taking a look under the hood. I think operationalizing financial health is that. It's taking a look under the hood to figure out why. And then as an organization, being able to, again, solution for so what. And so the way that's looked for us has been in a couple of ways. We have a financial learning and educational arm focused on certified coaching and both member at mass and one-on-one education. You've heard about partnerships with organizations like GreenPath. We have a couple of full-time, actually, staff on hand on behalf of GreenPath as certified counselors for that debt management process. But on the other end of it, operationalizing it has looked like strategic and innovative program and processes. So we've been able to bring online several different programs that have helped us to meet the needs of what some of the data has told us. For example, a Save to Win tool, where if we're talking about helping individuals get to that first 500 in savings and looking under the hood to find out why they're not doing it, some of it is behavior, habit, ability to save. Some of it is people are motivated differently, i.e. incentives and prizes. And so we were able to bring a solution online to meet that need. Operationalizing looks like bringing solutions online to meet the need or gap of someone that is experiencing a gap in getting to work. And we were able to bring a Wheels for Work program online that addressed some of the subprime auto lending that was going on in our community for individuals who may not have ideal credit scores or A-plus credit or even B credit. Through that program, we've helped over 1,000, I believe, individuals get to work. And so the purpose is to buy a vehicle in a prime, you know, in an ideal environment financially. The ratios for that have been great on repayment because people are working. And so it not only was about meeting the need of a vehicle, and it wasn't about an auto loan for us. It was to meet what I call a purpose-built need, which was helping people get to work, right? We've had some opportunities to help streamline the experience for entrepreneurs who need greater access to capital, but not only greater access to capital, greater access to the education and ecosystem in our community that helps them actually sustain a business beyond that first or second year when most businesses fail. And so operationalizing for us has looked like, what can we do to actually provide the financial learning and educational components? Where can we provide the products and solutions when they make sense? And like I call them, they make sense when they aren't necessarily making sense to make sense, the dollars and cents, but make sense because they fulfill the purpose of the credit union. And then when can we work in collaboration with other organizations, such as a GreenPath, other nonprofits, other community entities, to fill some of those gaps that really aren't our swim lane, but are an important swim lane to ensure that the need for the member is being met.
Kristen, how about you? I mean, you shared Kim's story, but kind of at a macro level for your whole client population, how do you think about measuring financial health? Are there patterns that you see in counseling that traditional metrics might miss? Just kind of maybe pick up on some of the stuff that Ivy and you were talking about.
Sure. You know, the biggest thing we hear from people who reach out to us is they wish they would have reached out sooner. And, you know, debt carries such a stigma, and people are so They're ashamed. They feel like they're going to be judged, even though they never will if they reach out to us. And they always feel better as soon as they talk to us because we tell them, you're not alone. It's not your fault. And you're going to be okay. And so, but that gap in time and for how long people struggle with the situation and just try to make the best decisions that they can come up with, but they may be making decisions that aren't in the best interest of their financial health, it's a real problem. And so I agree 100% with Taylor that there is a great opportunity to reach people with the right products at the right time of need. And I think we're just missing that, and we have to figure out how to break through that. When people are calling us, and we our data shows that they have on average about $25,000 in credit card debt, and then we're able to look back in the metrics and see that they had about $19,000 in credit card debt 12 months before. So they're paying these exorbitant rates for a very long time on a very tight budget that is probably a deficit. And they're making it work by using the credit cards, and that debt continues to grow. And so I think that's just one of the metrics that doesn't show up is how long people are waiting and how long, you know, they're struggling with it before they seek out partnership and help.
Sean, you asked me a double question there that I didn't answer one piece of it, but what Kristen just said reminded me of it. You asked me, were there any surprises? What has been a surprise in my mind, and it speaks to what Kristen said, is as we've been able to operationalize and bring solutions online to support individuals in their different financial journeys, the number of times that we hear someone say, not even they just didn't know educationally the process, but they weren't aware of the solutions to help them address them. The number of times that we've heard someone say, no one taught me this, but also I didn't know this existed or was available to me. And probably a little bit of, you know, proximity bias, you know, in my mind, like how don't you know about all these wonderful good things? But I do think it speaks to the necessity of storytelling and the necessity of collaborative storytelling to make sure that the ability to address accessibility and awareness comes from more than one channel. Because we think we're, you know, telling all the good news and we've got the megaphone and everyone's going to hear it from our voices, but it's probably more effective and powerful to leverage that storytelling across industry and across organizations. And so that was one thing that was kind of surprising as we started scoring and using the scores to help us to make those decisions, was the number of times people just weren't aware of even solutions that may have already existed that were available for them.
Sean, if I might, I just want to, you know, underscore the points that Kristen and Ivy have made and connect to some of the conversations that we were hearing earlier around AI. You know, the three scarcities, Tim, I think you had mentioned this, the three scarcities that people face. You know, we are so often focused on scarcity and resources and miss the very profound scarcity in time and attention that are just as impactful in shaping how people make decisions about their finances and even, you know, the kind of profound information asymmetries that they face and understanding what are the options available to them. We'll probably talk maybe a little bit about AI towards the end of the conversation if we have time, but I'll just note, you know, I think that there's opportunity and risk there in helping people sort of navigate those three scarcities when it comes to, you know, sort of supporting good financial decision making in a really complex and fragmented financial services landscape.
Yeah, I agree.
Fair game to bring in AI at any point. I think I just want to keep building on this discussion about putting the insights into action and what's working. Kristen, you kind of already started talking about this, but you know, I know you have a new safety net product for people who are managing debt with you. Can you walk us through, for example, how that works, what makes it effective?
Yes, so I'm very excited that we will soon be launching a new safety net product where the customers who are repaying their debt with us will also start to build an emergency savings. You want to talk about slack. 57% of the people who call us are already using 90% of their available credit. So again, they're waiting very long and they have no slack left. And so that's when they are reaching out. When we go through the process of creating a budget with a person and balancing that budget, we always include a minimum of $25 of savings per month in that budget. What we haven't done until now is actually automate that savings. So now we are using behavioral economics, we are stacking the habits, so when a person decides they want to enroll in a debt management plan and repay their debt, they are also deciding to enroll in the safety net program, and it's just all stacked together and explained, and like, this is gonna make you successful on this program, and we are automating the payments first to the debt management plan, and then second, to the separate safety net account. And so ideally, you know, a person's taking 3 to 5 years to repay their debt, they're going to run into a financial shock. And one of the things we've learned through our client interviews is that people are often taking on other debt because they have nothing to fall back on. So while they're successfully, you know, making ground on the debt they enrolled with us, meanwhile, they've taken on something else over here when that shock happens because they didn't have the emergency fund to rely on. So now, when they encounter that shock, they'll be able to reach out to GreenPath, either use the emergency fund to make their debt payment or to take care of the shock. And we're just so excited to be able to stack Amazing. Those habits and have measurements that will include not only repaying debt, but building savings at the same time.
Yeah, that's an exciting one, and I'm sure Taylor and others who have frameworks for financial health, like the combination of the idea of the emergency savings and the sustainable credit and kind of bringing that all together in a way that works for the consumer's actual life and the way mm-hmm. they would think about them in interconnected ways. Ivy, you'd kind of been talking about some other innovations and connecting the insights into action. So I don't know if you have anything more to elaborate and also want to hear from Taylor on kind of what you're hearing from members and kind of what's most exciting for you from an innovation perspective across the ecosystem. So.
Yeah, one innovation that we're really excited about, I would say that I'm excited about most of the things I've already shared with you because just the ability to be unique in meeting members where they are excites me. But there is one that in the last 2 years we've really been working on that is an expression of partnership, collaboration, and community investment, coaching, and solutions all paired in one. And I believe the recipe for financial health success includes all of those ingredients. And that is a partnership that we have for what we call our Pathways to Home Ownership initiative. In our community, we have a very high renter audience, especially in one specific zip code area that is also socioeconomically disadvantaged. And we came into partnership with a nonprofit partner as a community quarterback, an organization that's also a nonprofit that handles education and family outcomes and data. Our foundation made a seed investment of $1.3 million. There's a construction company on board, and then our coaching and educational aspect, and then another nonprofit that has come on board for the certified counseling element to help build and create up to 30 successful first-time home buyers. When we look at our first-time home buyer portfolio, it is a very large element of who we are able to serve. And again, it's not about the, you know, how much money we make off of having first-time home buyers. It's the reality that, as our president says, they can get in the game, they can stay in the game. You've bought your first home, you typically have built now the confidence and understanding and learning to do it again or to at least sustain that. We want to make sure that that is a true process. And so we've been able to partner with those entities that I mentioned to not only build the homes, because we are not baseball. If we build it, they'll come. That would be nice. But we want to make sure, again, successful sustenance and maintaining of the home as one of the key wealth generators for families. And we, like I said, we were able to make the investment for the initial homes being built. And we are so excited that as of last week, the first 5 homes were completed and have been sold. And yes, and so the first 5 homeowners are in the homes. The second 5 homes are coming online by fall. There is a pipeline of individuals who have been now coached and educated and created a savings plan and sometimes a debt management plan. So the credit readiness is there. And and the activity is there. And what's happening is, you know, the tide is being lifted by everyone. I like to believe many hands make light work and many hands make impactful work. And that's one of the examples that we're seeing very tangibly. So we're really excited about that because it has several elements and components to it. And we're seeing the tangible results of people are owning their homes in an environment where I believe it's 73% right now is renter environment. And so what we know about renter environments is not only are, you know, you're not getting the asset of the ownership, but it's also in the environment we're in very subject to outside of community investors. And we are navigating that like many communities around the country are. And so it also helps to preserve the spirit of very local, community-driven impact work. So we're really excited about that.
Taylor?
Yeah, I mean, I think that both of these are fantastic examples of innovations that have been spurred by insights into what people's financial health ambitions and needs and challenges really are. Most financial institutions, forgive me, most financial institutions
Fair.
Think day-to-day in terms of product.
Yep.
They don't think in terms of experiences.
No.
And I do think that the most powerful innovations that we're seeing are those that really center consumer experience in ways that allow institutions and partnerships, groups of institutions, to connect the dots mm-hmm. in ways that don't leave people siloed with one challenge and try to solve that challenge with one product. I also think that institutions get stuck because they don't always have a shared standard for what good looks like when
yes.
it comes to financial health. And at Financial Health Network, you know, we've committed to help try to fill that gap, not only by defining and measuring financial health for households and consumers, but also by defining some product level standards mm-hmm. around, you know, again, like what does good look like for consumers? So we've launched these financial health standards as an evidence-based framework to ensure that financial products include features that we know are linked to improved financial health, starting with checking accounts and credit cards. And we feel that financial institutions really need this kind of specific guidance and comparative benchmarking at the product level to break through this barrier between commitment and action. But ultimately, what we really want people to be doing, like the true cutting edge of innovation, is in kind of designing for consumer experience in a mm-hmm. way that allows people to connect, for example, you know, debt repayment, credit building, home buying, and wealth building, to really think about that consumer financial health journey much more holistically.
Those are all really interesting examples. Quick time check, we probably have another 15 minutes or so before I want to turn to audience questions. And I want to talk a little bit, maybe a little bit out of order, but you just mentioned collaboration, kind of coordination partnerships, Taylor, and I'd love to hear Kristen and Ivy kind of jump in on that topic and talk about the role partnerships play in promoting financial health, but also kind of coming to conclusions on, you know, what good is and how you measure it and then design for it.
Yeah. As I mentioned, I think that many hands make impactful work, and I think collaboration is everything. There's something to be said about what we've heard several times today about the trust building and rapport building element of financial health or helping someone on their financial journey. And I think it's important for us to acknowledge the role that we all do or don't play in that, right? The role that we play as a financial institution, we're very trusted by our credit union members. We also recognize that nonprofit partners are very trusted by the communities that they serve, right? Even more so than us by our members. We recognize that we all have opportunity to run in the lane of expertise that we've been created for. So what is that swim lane? Not necessarily driving lane, because we can be fluid in it, but what's the swim lane? So I think collaboration is critical in that. When I think about the Federal Reserve, for example, there are several solutions and the FinHealth standards that, you know, you all can help shape for the environments by which we play in and stay in, and how there could be partnership there in the storytelling and getting the word out. I was talking earlier to someone just about the reality of tender environments, or, you know, unique environments call for collaboration, because while you may have the resource and the interest and the information, I may have the proximity and the access and the rapport, and Taylor may have the innovative tool and solution, and Sean may have the financial resource to get it done, right? And so, especially in environments where trust may be of question, familiarity may be of question, that collaboration can help mission be accomplished. And so I just think collaboration is critical in creating the not only the learning, but the pathway to moving the needle on financial health.
Yeah, I'll just build on that. Our entire work is built on partnerships, the 600 credit union partners that we have across the country, being able to offer GreenPath as a trusted resource in that time of need. And I'd also like to highlight, so we partner with 401k record keepers. Empower Financial is one of our great partners. And within their online experience, if a person is seeking a loan from their 401k loan or from their 401k, they are offered the opportunity to connect with GreenPath to understand, you know, what other options might be available for them so that they don't tap into their retirement in order to solve a short-term financial problem, which might have other options that can be good for it. Because debt management and nonprofit debt management is really not known and people don't understand it, they don't even know that's available, and they might end up with a product that's going to hurt their credit, like debt settlement could hurt their credit tremendously, especially if they are current at the time of reaching out to that kind of a company. Getting that referral at the time that they're making the decision of like, ooh, I'm thinking borrowing from my 401k would be a good idea right now, they can talk to a nonprofit certified credit counselor to understand, like, different choices that they might make to solve that situation. But they'll never find out about us if they don't have that referral from Empower at the time.
I might take a slightly different angle on this question around partnerships and collaboration to, you know, as someone who leads a research team, to really think about the value of collaboration in the world of data and insights. I think financial health data is a public good. You know, like inflation or unemployment, household financial health data offers us a shared record of how people are doing. And I think it provides us with a shared floor on which institutions can innovate, right? Mm-hmm. And in many ways compete on, you know, what they do with those financial health insights. One of the most important areas of innovation in financial services right now, at least when it comes to financial health and financial health measurement, is in supplementing really good survey data with analysis of administrative data, whether those are credit records or, in particular for financial institutions, account and transactional data. Mm-hmm. Right now, all of that innovation is happening, or most of that innovation is happening inside of financial institutions. And they're doing it often in isolation with no real common vocabulary or reference framework. And so each one of them is kind of reinventing the wheel. So we think it's really important to really kind of jumpstart coordination around the use of administrative data in understanding how consumers are faring financially. So Financial Health Network has recently launched a new financial health measurement industry working group to develop some of that shared understanding and shared frameworks for measuring consumer financial health using administrative data. Our goal is to really give providers and other stakeholders that common and practical foundation for understanding the financial lives of the people they serve with the data that they already have. And so, you know, shout out to the Fed for being a real partner in helping elevate the importance of financial health measurement, whether that's using really good survey data like with the Shed, or encouraging financial institutions to leverage the administrative data that they already have available to them. These are really powerful opportunities, I think, for cross-sector collaboration. and to provide a much more continuous and granular understanding of people's financial lives.
Mm-hmm. So I'm going to try to fit in two more questions very quickly. We only have maybe 5 minutes to allow some audience questions, but and so maybe not everyone has to answer this if you don't want to, but can we just very quickly talk about the business case more broadly? We've talked a lot about the benefits to consumers of all stripes, but particularly the vulnerable. How would you quickly make the business case? Taylor, you mentioned it earlier, but maybe how would you describe that?
I'm happy to take it, but Ivy, maybe you can talk a little bit about like what has been your experience at RightPath?
Sure. So I've already talked about all of the opportunities for, you know, bringing solutions online, and while they may not be loan or deposit revenue generating opportunities first, the bottom line is they do generate those opportunities, right? But on the other side, what we have seen as we've leveraged the financial health scoring and surveying at the local level and then used that for financial coaching and educational opportunities, we have seen that our educated and engaged members are stickier members. They stay with us. They tend to have more solutions per member. They tend to, when they've gone through our engagements, you know, kind of using the scores and the education that we wrap around it, they tend to pay their debts down more actively and increase their savings consistently. And so we do have data, and I apologize, I don't have the exact number today, but we do have data tied to individuals that engage our financial health journey resources compared to those who don't. And we do see a difference in that space. Now, we love our members, and we have very sticky members anyway, who they may not pay 10 other bills, but they will pay the things that are provided to us. And we do believe it's because of things like we're not only providing product and solution, we're genuinely walking through a financial health journey.
Yeah, and I would just add, the business case for like the financial health work that we do is that we're approaching the person holistically. You know, these problems don't happen in a vacuum. And when someone can get a holistic action plan with like how to manage their financial life in this moment, everyone's going to be better off. The Absolutely. Person's going to be better off, but the creditors are going to be better off too, because they're going to get paid in full and on time, maybe at a slightly lower interest rate or significantly lower interest rate if they go on a debt management plan, but they're still getting paid in full, which is a much better result than a bankruptcy or a settlement.
Yeah. When we survey consumers across the entire country, we consistently see a desire perception gap. In, you know, roughly 80% of consumers say that they want their financial institution to help them improve their financial health. Only 14% on average think mm-hmm. that their financial institution is actually doing it. Whatever's actually happening, mm-hmm. You know, that's the perception gap. And there's where I think real business value lies. We've also done some work to look at consumers' actual engagements with the primary financial institutions, and we see that those consumers who say that their primary financial institution is supporting their financial health, to back up Ivy's points, across financial institutions, we see that they're 3 times more satisfied, 3 times more likely to recommend their PFI, 2 times more likely to stay at their PFI long-term, and 5 times more likely to buy additional products.
Okay, very quick lightning round. 1 to 2 sentences if you could answer this. Magic wand question. If you could change one thing about how the ecosystem approaches financial health, particularly for vulnerable customers and consumers, what would it be? Kristen?
That people would find the trusted guides in the process and not end up where they shouldn't.
That there'd be a standardized way to gauge it and a collaborative way to solution for it, that we would work in collaboration.
That we would really change the mindset of practitioners in particular about consumer financial behavior, that consumers don't make decisions on the basis of single products, but are making them on the basis of trying to piece together, you know, a variety of different solutions across a whole bunch of different providers to address, you know, financial health ambitions, aspirations, needs, and challenges, but they're not doing it on a product-by-product basis.
No. Thank you. Questions from the audience?
Hi, thank you for your comments and your discussion. Questions for Ivy and Kristen. I'm curious whether or not you partner with high schools or junior high school for financial literacy for children or young adults. And then for Taylor, I don't know if your database tracks whether or not the individuals have financial literacy as young adults, and whether or not that has an impact on, you said their scores ebb and flow over time. So could it be that, and it's a question, if they had access to financial literacy programs earlier on, it had better outcomes later throughout life, longer term?
So, yes, we actually have a K through 12 state-aligned curriculum. Ohio is a financial literacy mandated state. But we have a state-aligned curriculum called Money Magnifier, and we provide it in community for K through 12 audiences as kits and tools, but we do also have a dedicated financial learning coordinator that is engaging the 9 through 12 audience specifically, and then we have partnerships with our local universities to provide that partner education into young adulthood as well. So, yes, and then there was a What was the other part of the question? Oh, that was it for me, right? Okay.
And while we don't partner directly with educational institutions, we impact the children of the families that we are working with by really starting the conversation. So we have stories from our clients where they're sharing, like, they're bringing their kids along in this budget conversation and like, okay, we're needing to cut back on this, or here, you know, here's, we're so proud of the debt we were able to repay, and like now we were able to achieve our dream of buying a home. And so like we're trying to destigmatize the conversation and have it come from, you know, the families who are making these great choices and improving their situation.
Just briefly in response to your question, we don't have great data ourselves on the links between early childhood financial education and later life outcomes for adults. Financial Health Network doesn't, but there's great research on this. Carly Urban is one researcher who's done a lot of work on high school financial education and, you know, looking at what works best, when and how does it, you know, work best, and, you know, really sort of evaluating some of the capability outcomes among individuals who go through that kind of education. But I'll just double down on the points that you know, Tim Flacca from Commonwealth and Governor Barr made earlier about the very valuable shift that I think has occurred around our understanding of financial education, from the idea that it's an information and knowledge problem to the idea that it's actually about capability and confidence. Yeah. And the ability to create products and build products, institutions, and systems in which people have the information that they need to make the right choices in the right moment. So I think it's really less a question about you know, education per se, and more a question about institutional design.
And just to close on that, I think that's where it's important. We don't use the term financial education. We talk about financial learning and financial management, and really to your point, capability building, right? And so what we have is state aligned, but we have tried to approach it in partnership, even with some of our community partners, in the design of it to be relevant to those on time, just in time, on demand topics that really are about, as you're going through each stage in your, you know, life journey, what does that mean for your financial journey, and how do we teach to that? How do you cash your first check? How do you purchase a car and negotiate a car? You know, we talked about the company that can do it for you earlier, right? Like, how are you an advocate for yourself in that way? How do you not fall prey to predatory credit and lending things? How do you start to invest safely and effectively?
So I think we might have run out of time. You had so much great stuff to share. Didn't have time for more questions. But thank you so much, Taylor, Kristen, and Ivy, for this great conversation, engaging with us on this important work. And just want to say that we are committed to supporting work through research and collaboration. And if you're implementing financial health measurement or want to learn from others doing this work, please connect with me or my colleagues. You can find us after the panel or online. We want to keep engaging. So thank you, everyone, for joining us. And thank you for the conversation, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you all very much for attending our conference this year. This has been just exciting. I want to especially thank those who were joining us online. So many thanks to our virtual attendees. We expected this year's theme on the next generation of financial inclusion to bring tremendous energy to the conference discussion, and I think indeed it did. So before I close out the conference, because I know what I'm standing in front of, let me share another innovative resource that is now public. Our colleagues at the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston have launched a new Inclusive Payments Resource Center, which is a website that highlights opportunities to advance financial inclusion through payments. You'll see the QR code is up there. Please snap it. Check it out. The site aims to provide households who are unbanked and underbanked with tools and information that can give them access to safer, more affordable options than the ones that they rely on today. So really happy with these new innovations that are coming out of the Federal Reserve System, and greatly support how they are helping to move and advance financial inclusion. So before we all leave and head upstairs for a reception, let me just add my thanks to the many contributors behind the scenes who played an important role in making today successful. On the logistics team, we had Bianca Markovic, Yvette Harvey, Candace Thomas, and Jatson Miller. And on the planning team, Jennifer Fernandez, Kirsten Nolan, Emily Hirschman, Shalise Fryer, and Gracie Griffin. Just give them a round of applause.